Welcome to another episode of This Is Hot Boga. Happy that you're here.
I'm ready to get this rocking and rolling.
Before we dive into all these bow hunting subjects, I would like to spend a few minutes talking about and thanking some of the companies that make this podcast possible. So first up, Sturka Optics. We run a bunch of their glass.
Love the glass.
Everything from spotting scopes to binoculars. They have stuff entry level to, you know, very high end. And they have a fantastic warranty. So if you're going to be looking for binoculars in the near future, go to SturkaStrong.com. You'll do yourself a huge favor.
Best in the industry. Check them out. So another company that we really like is New Breed Archery. They've got fantastic products. They're really built well. They're made here in America. Kyle's really done a fantastic job assembling an awesome team. We got to talk to him a few episodes back. So
Check out that episode, too. You learned a lot about the company.
Yeah, it was a great talk. Check them out.
Next up is Black Eagle Arrows. They make fantastic carbon shafts.
You have yet to break one.
No, I broke my first one the other day.
First time.
Which I've shot thousands of shots. And just from switching from compound to traditional archery, you're going to miss the target a lot. Mm-hmm. So I did. And they held up really well. Go to blackeaglearrows.com to get yourself.
If you guys don't know what ASAC camo is, it's pretty much one of the only camo companies that doesn't use green in their camo pattern. And there's a reason for that. It's because green is really the only color for bugs, birds, and reptiles. Wear something that you're actually going to use and it's going to help you. ASAC camo, check them out.
All right, another company that supports our podcast is Burris Optics. They make something really cool. It's called the Oracle Bow Sight. And it's a rangefinder combined with a bow sight. It instantly ranges it, adjusts your sight, and it's fantastic. It's totally worth checking out. BurrisOptics.com.
Gear definitely gives you advantage over the animals. And nothing or nobody does it better than FHF gear. Good gear really stacks the odds in your favor, and nobody does it better than FHF gear. They hold our S7s beautifully. Check them out. Fish Hunt Fight Gear.
Excellent. Well, thanks for joining us, guys. You want to, before we go too much farther, you want to just introduce yourselves and, you know, tell us a little bit about your background in hunting and how you're involved with Hill People Gear.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go first. Kevin McDowell, I'm the operations manager for Hill People Gear, among other things. I have a background in the Marine Corps and wildland firefighting, and that's actually how I met Casey, was wildland firefighting. I don't have a background in hunting, except for the times I've been with Casey and filming him.
So I'm Casey Gorsett. I work part-time for Hill People Gear when I'm not involved in my career in wildland fire for the Forest Service. You know, Kevin and I built a friendship through wildland fire, and we kind of carried that into the Hill People Gear side of things when he came over here. Mm-hmm. And it's just been great. It's been an awesome, it's just great gear, and it gets us out in the woods and gets us out in the backcountry, and that's what we love about it.
Yeah, and you guys are taking, I mean, phenomenal pictures out there. Some of the stuff with, you know, I was reading through, I think, Kevin, your profile and your Instagram profile, and I mean, you've got some awesome pictures. Have you been in photography for a while?
I'd say about 3 years, like, seriously doing it. Before that, it was just like, you know, cell phone photography. Then, you know, I bought a camera and just been kind of fanatical about it ever since, so... I'm always trying to get out there just to take pictures. So
yeah, maybe you can send some photography tips over here to James, because he's just not the greatest photographer.
Well, so Jared's like the I mean,
it's like anything. It's a process. It's, you know, learning it is just,
it's all about,
it's
the
like
rule
anything.
Of thirds.
You know, say again?
It's about the rule of thirds. So like, that's what I like to tell them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's all of that, you know, and it's a journey for sure.
Yeah, I'm usually like very caught up in the moment, so I'm just taking pictures and more. You know, I'm hardly focusing on that. I don't know. Usually it's blurry. Jared hurts my feelings a little bit every time I like say, hey, let's post these pictures. He's like, no, you can't post those. I'm like, why? Those are great pictures. He's like, no, they're terrible.
No, we're not posting that.
No, that's just embarrassing.
I got high standards. If Casey takes a picture of me or something like that, it's like, hey, no. Yeah, you can't do that one.
Yep. Every group has to have one. We're the D-bags of the group, man.
Yeah, so you got wildfire fighters. Is that right?
Wildland.
Yeah. Wildland. What's that like?
Okay. So wildland firefighting, we worked for the U.S. Forest Service. There's multiple different federal agencies that fight fire. The U.S. Forest Service is the primary one. Basically, you're fighting wildfires and you're managing or fighting wildfires, not doing anything with the structure side of firefighting. So typically when you tell, you know, someone that you're a firefighter, they don't They associate that with structure, but we're not allowed to even come close to structures pretty much. So you're out in the backcountry for 14 days at a time, all summer long, and you're just fighting fire, 16 hour days and doing all kinds of crazy stuff.
Cutting trees, digging line.
Wow. So you haul all your stuff out. I would imagine you're camping out there. Is that right?
Yeah. Sometimes you have a established fire camp that's far away from the fire, and sometimes you do what's called spiking out, and then you have a little bit less gear. Sometimes people bring food out to you to wherever you're camping out.
Yes, and I would imagine packing gear out in your back is pretty important for that. Are you guys using your packs for fighting fires out there?
So usually on a crew, you're issued a certain type of pack, whatever, because they want to be uniform. Yeah. We didn't use like Hill People Gear packs when we were fighting fire. We were used to the packs we were issued.
Okay.
I wish I would.
Yeah. We all wish that we had a Hill People Gear line pack. It's not out yet. So
what's training look like for guys like you? So, how long ago did you just sign up? And once you signed up, what was it like being kind of onboarded onto the firefighting, wilderness crew?
You want to get that?
Yeah.
Go.
I've been doing it for 7 years now. So I started basically right out of high school at 18. And Kevin started right out of the Marine Corps pretty much after a little bit of education. And
went to college after.
Yeah. And so it's kind of one of those things where if people ask how to get into it, it's not a straightforward answer. And you could have quite a long conversation about it. But just applying for jobs and being in the right place at the right time. Then with the training aspect of it, it just varies crew to crew and what your assignments are.
Yeah, it's not about how much you can lift. It's just how much can you hike?
Sure.
can you carry weight and hike?
So how far would you guys be going then, I guess, to the backcountry? Are you talking like a couple miles out of like town or, are you talking?
On the trailhead.
Yeah, or at the trailhead.
I mean, sometimes you're in wilderness areas. I mean, where you want to park as close as you possibly can.
Sure.
Yeah. To it, And sometimes, it's a mile or so. And then sometimes it's miles upon miles. So it definitely varies.
So would this then be a place where you guys are just all meeting up as a crew and then like punching out, or do you guys all just meet up at one like grid point and then move out? Like I'm clueless. So just kind of fill us in here.
So the crews typically, whether that be a hot shot, a helicopter, or a engine fire crew for the Forest Service, you're going to be working together all summer, basically from the springtime through the fall. And okay. So you'll all, arrive together as a unit and then begin operations based on how the operations are planned out for the day or days.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so then when you're out there, I'm going to assume you're also scouting for mm-hmm. elk and
I see what you guys are doing
and stuff. Is that what this really is about?
You're always doing a little bit of shed hunting on the side and whatnot. And always looking for the next burn area and hunting spot for sure. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah, your season's done for the year though. The hunting's done by you, right?
Yeah, actually, hunting's done for me. I had a little bit of an extended season this year because I was able to go down to Sonora, Mexico to hunt coos deer.
Oh, wow. Looking at your pick, you got a nice buck.
Yeah, I did. I got a really nice non-typical coos deer. It was an amazing hunt. A lot of hard work. I mean, that was day 5 into the whole thing. And certainly the best deer we saw the entire trip. So it was a good time.
The gray ghost, is that what they're called?
Yeah, a lot of people have heard of them as the gray ghost, and they totally live up to that name. For example, you could be sitting glassing with 3 other guys or whatnot, and you see a flash of a deer just move through the grass or the brush, and
right.
You're like, oh, I got one. And everyone asks, Where is he? And you're like, I can't tell you. Like, I have to stay on this area and just watch him to move again. And the country down there is very nondescript as well. It's very uniform,
right.
As far as like the bunch of grass. So it's tough, and they'll just disappear on you. I mean, we were watching this one deer at 200 yards the second to last day.
Yep.
We watched him bed down, and then we sat on his area just waiting for him to stand up again until it got dark. And he obviously just slipped out on us because they usually won't go more than an hour or two without moving.
Right.
So they're pretty finicky critters. Really cool. And that was my first whitetail hunt of any kind as well. So
You got to come out east. You got to experience some of the trials and tribulations of Michigan hunting. It's cold. You're going to see a lot of small deer. And a lot of hunters.
A lot of hunters.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's really, it's on my list of, one of the next, hunts I want to do is an Eastern whitetail hunt. It's fascinating, and it's totally foreign to me coming from, you know, hunting out west in Colorado, starting early, you know, as early as you can, hunting small game and grouse and whatnot, and then harvesting antelope at 12 and 13, my first elk at 14. So it's, I'm pretty used to the Western hunting style. So that's kind of a totally new challenge that I'm not familiar with, but I'd like to be.
Yeah, it's funny. Ever since we started hunting west, it's changed how we actually hunt when we're back by us. You know, growing up, it was you walk out an hour and a half before daylight, you get in your stand, you wait 45 minutes for the sun to come up, you sit till, you know, for a couple hours. And now we've, I just really ended up liking how much you get to move.
The mobility.
It's just, you get sick of sitting around. Not like I don't still do it, but I try to get moving a little bit more, you know, as well.
Well, and I'm not very familiar with the tactics, but when you guys are out there, are you primarily sitting for an entire day, or are you going to move a couple stands in a day, or what's usually your protocol out there?
There's times throughout the year, definitely during the rut where, I mean, if the weather's right and you've got a good wind position on wherever you're sitting, I guess a lot of it comes into if you've been able to pattern those deer and had like the time to find out where they're feeding, where travel routes are, bedding area. I mean, it's not very uncommon for people to sit all day.
Several days.
In one spot.
Yeah.
One stand location.
See, the way that I do it, I used to do it out of a tree. I had a climber slip, and I'm like, you know, I kind of fell. I didn't fall that bad, but it was like, I don't know. I don't like
enough
how
to make you poop a little.
Yeah, you don't like it. And then you're like, I feel like when you're in a tree stand, you're really stuck there. So I ended up getting, you know, I found one of those Helinox chairs. I got some, what is that, burlap camo stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I set up ground blinds. And a lot of times, even if I'm sitting all day, I'll sit. And then if I feel like the wind is changing or, you know, whatever happens and I feel like I need to move a little bit, then in 5 minutes, you're quietly wrapped
up.
You
have the option to do it.
Yeah. Slowly move to another area. And that way you don't feel like you're, I guess, one of the drawbacks of whitetail hunting in a stand is you feel like you've committed to that spot and you really can't move once you're in there. So, you know, trying to mix that up with a little like ground and pound hunting, I think works pretty well.
Well, I mean, just with how thick it is out there and with no relief in topography, I mean, it'd be essentially starting from square one other than, you know, checking the wind and the basics for me. You know, I'm so used to just, I like to hunt in areas where there's a lot you can see, there's a lot of relief in topography, and that it's not so thick. So you're actually able to spot the animals and primarily spot and stalk hunting, keeping it, you know, active throughout the day depending on what happens. Yeah, that's totally different, but I'm ready to do that challenge for sure.
It's a lot of fun. It's good to have a mix of everything, you know. And old Mexico coos deer hunting is very high on my list. How was it when you decided to go? How long have you been planning that trip to go down south?
A couple of years. A friend who also is another wildland firefighter that I know, he has got good connections through his family on getting tags and all that and all the processes down there in Mexico. So they really made it a smooth process. We've been talking about it for a couple of years. And then, you know, about summer of this year, so 6-7 months out, it came out that, okay, yeah, we have the tags, you know, this is the cost, XYZ, this is what we need to do. And, you know, honestly, like, they put in a bunch of the legwork as far as the gun permits go and all of that kind of stuff, the ranch we were hunting, the tags we were getting. So really, I was lucky to have good friends who had the connections. It was, you know, it's still, you know, had to get insurance for my truck and everything. I drove my own truck down there, which was interesting. I was glad I had it once I got there because I wouldn't have wanted to be in any less of a reliable vehicle. But it was interesting, but they put in a lot of the legwork. So I think it's all about, you know, there are different groups of people that are running outfits down there where you can do a do-it-yourself hunt like I did. You just need the right processes for getting the gun permits and the tags and whatnot. Because you're not really applying with the state of, you know, with the government down there like you do in the states. The landowners get the tags, then they sell them to a tag broker, then the tag broker sells them to you.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like a 3 or 4 step down process to the end. But there's options out there for sure.
So the border, there's some issues in the news and stuff with border issues. We'll leave it at that. Did that make crossing the border any more interesting than you thought it would be? Was there any weirdness there?
No, not at all, actually. It was totally I would say as smooth as you could expect, really. Okay. There were no issues. There wasn't anything different. As far as I was told by the people that were with us that had done it before, it was no different than standard procedure. I would say that that's a lot of, what the news is saying and less of reality.
Right. So, mm-hmm.
It was definitely interesting, then. Interesting to be down then.
So you crossed in, you met up with your outfitter out there. Did they basically say, direct you where to go, or did you have just a giant swath of land to go glass? Because I would imagine you spent most of your time, sitting and glassing out there.
Yeah, basically. So, we arrive at the ranch and they kind of lay us out on, okay, you basically can go 12 miles back this way, 12 miles that, they're laying out, and it's just massive, massive amounts of land, tens of thousands of acres that are privately held down there.
Okay.
So even though it is private land and it's not public land hunting like I'm used to back in the States, you feel as if you're on a massive chunk of public land, undisturbed. It doesn't feel like you're on, if you were hunting private land or ranch stateside. It's very different. So it feels very wild in experience itself.
So. Oh, it's so untouched down there compared to even some of the more remote places up in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm guessing you brought, a good pack worth of stuff, and I'm sure you went Hill People gear pack while you're down there. How do you pack for a hunt like this? What was in your pack when you went down?
All right. So it's a highly high optics hunt, as I'm sure you're familiar with. So not only was I running with my 10 power binoculars on my chest, but I had 15 power binoculars in my pack at all times, and a spotting scope too. And throughout the day, I was using all three optics for different purposes. So heavy on the optics, pack wise, a lot less insulation. Less heavy clothing because it was a little bit warmer, and just basically carrying good survival gear too, not knowing what to expect, always being ready with medical gear and different survival gear for, somewhat of the worst case scenario down there. But I was running the Hill People Gear Ute pack.
Yeah.
I've been wondering about that one. Yeah. So that's my go-to for hunting. Great load carriage system, and Kevin can definitely get more into the dynamics on the design of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to hear more. Yeah, I was looking at that one, and what I found really interesting was that it compresses so small, where at least compared to a lot of other packs around that size.
Yeah, we're definitely big on the compression aspect of the packs.
Did you take any of your Marine Corps gear experience and kind of adapt some of that into there? Because I know when I was in the Marine Corps, I don't know, I loved all the gear. I loved messing with it. Yeah. I mean, those main packs were like, I was like, this is awesome. Not to say I'd ever get another one, but did you take any of that concept and apply it to this stuff? Or what entails how you guys kind of design these packs?
So I'm not the designer. The designer is actually Evan Hill, who is one of the owners. His brother, Scott Hill, is the co-owner. So they both were Eagle Scouts, and they both have a background working for the Forest Service as well.
Okay.
They both did that. No military experience. So I can give some concepts of, what I've learned from the military and what's applicable. But really, I mean, everything that they design is applicable anyways. It's not designed for military use or for certain hunting uses. It's just general use that you can use across all these applications.
Of course. Absolutely.
So yeah, but basically the design of the packs comes from Evan and Scott and what they found lacking in load carriage systems available on the market. So really unique to it is the lumbar and frame system that directs the weight of the pack into the pelvis and the lumbar area. And that's really the center of gravity of your body. And that's where you want to carry the weight. You don't want to have your shoulders overloaded down because that can lead to injury.
Yeah, so you think about it as like a large lumbar pack. Even our backpacking style packs, we want all the weight to be married to the lumbar and the shoulder straps, the shoulder harness. You think of it as just keeping the load stabilized.
Right. Oh, yeah. That makes sense. Yep. Before we move on in this conversation, we're going to take a quick second to introduce a new segment called Mastering Glass with Sturka Optics, where we bring on Josh, the product manager from Sturka, to answer a few quick questions about glassing. These are all questions that we get on our social media page, so if you have some, shoot us a message and we'll make sure to get him answering those questions. All right, Josh, what is the most important piece of advice you could give to someone to make them better at glassing?
The first thing, of course, is going to be to set up your binocular properly for your eyes. Going back to what we said previously in another segment, you want to make sure that that binocular is set to your eyes. After that, it's just be slow and take your time. You don't want to just kind of pan all over the place. You want to be very, very consistent of how you're glassing. So you want to look at, say you want to look at underbrush first, like kind of make sections out of where you're glassing, and just take the time to glass slowly and hit each and every one of those sections instead of just panning randomly all over the place. You'll miss a lot if you just do that. But if you take your time and kind of look in one section, glass it thoroughly, move to the next section, glass thoroughly, and kind of move that way, you have a better chance of actually seeing whether it be game or whatever it is that you happen to be looking for.
Great, thanks. And that was Mastering Glass with Sturka. Now back to our talk.
So you packed that thing full of stuff. You headed down to Mexico. When you were down there, did you have any accidents or anything? You have to rely on any of your survival stuff that you brought, or was it pretty easy going?
No, I actually didn't, which was a good thing. I'm, you know, always glad when I don't have to use that stuff, but it was definitely nice to have it, you know, and there were, how do I say this? There were a couple, you know, different guys in the group who definitely didn't have like the right gear for if something went amiss, you know, and I think that they were all, you know, they were asking me quite a bit about my gear loadout, you know, like, what are you carrying, you know? And so, yeah, no accidents or mishaps, but just wanted to be ready for anything really, you know, whether that be vehicle breakdowns, injuries. Yeah. I actually did slip on a rock fall while I was stocking up on that deer, and my pack did save me an inadvertently because I fell onto a rock pile right onto the pack. So
oh, right.
extra benefit, and it never lost shape or stride. So that's good. You know, durable gear, 500D construction on the Cordura. So running into rocks, scraping through bushes, it's going to hold up for a lifetime of use.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that. And a lot of times I'm asked this quite a bit, you know, via social media and stuff and even some friends. So one of the difficulties about picking out a pack right now, or at least one of the higher end packs, is that there are hardly any retail stores where you can try them on and see, you know, is this pack right for me? Is this pack right for me? So for the guy out there that's like looking at getting a pack, you know, he's a backcountry hunter. Maybe he's going west for the first time. What would you recommend for him to do, you know, in terms of sizing? How do you look at the internet, find the best pack, you know, without having very much time to try it on?
And that's a very good point, because it is difficult to determine which pack to pick just by looking at spec sheets from the internet as well. And what we found is that there is this kind of spec war going on,
right?
With like empty pack weights, like how light can you get this pack? And that's not the most important part of the pack. The most important part is how does it carry, and how does the weight, how do you perceive the weight,
right,
when it's carried on the body? Yeah. And then you're going to have to start with a container and then find out what you can put in it. There's always going to be a trade-off,
right,
of what you can take. Basically, you're going to want to find the size of the bag that you want, and then you're going to have to pick and choose what items go in that bag.
So, you know, say, let me think of a good scenario. So say a guy like me, right? I live in Michigan. I like to run and gun hunt for whitetail, you know, 95% of my years doing that are turkey hunting out here. And I'll go on the occasional 5 to 7 day backcountry hunt. You know, so far it's been in Colorado. I think we're talking Idaho.
Idaho.
What would you recommend in terms of cubic inches? You know, because that's a big question we're asked too. Like, well, is 3,000 or 5,200 or all the other seven thousands? Like, for what I'm describing, if I want to do it all pack, what would you recommend? First of all, the specs, and then, you know, which ones of your packs would you recommend?
You know, I would recommend either the Ute, which is like a 65 liter, or a the Kuya, which is close to 100 liters. And it's going to depend on, you know, what you're putting in it, because not all sleeping bags are right, made alike.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very bulky, and that can take up, you know, a third of some packs, and other ones, you know, it doesn't take up any space in your pack. So the main issue is going to be what exactly is going in it, and how bulky is that, material.
It, of course, be a sleeping bag, you know, a 0 degree compressible sleep. Yeah,
mine's not. I got mine. I went out there and I like something happened to mine, my other one.
And then
I got like a $70 one. And actually, it's really warm, but it does not fold down small at all.
You gotta get a compression sack.
That's usually the biggest thing, especially if you have like a synthetic bag. It's gonna be the big piece that goes in your pack. What's nice about our packs is that we usually run our sleeping bag on top because you can fill everything inside and then just cap the sleeping bag on top with the compression straps. So that's definitely a nice feature to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, modularity of the system, I would say, would be important. If you're looking into what kind of pack can get me through multiple scenarios with a one buy all instead of having, oh, well, I need to buy a 7,000 cubic inch pack, but I also need a 3,000 for different missions. That's where the compression system and the modularity of a pack like the Ute is really nice. Because as you were mentioning, the pack compresses with a double compression system. Yep. So it can be as big as the pack can be, and you can build it up or down with the compression straps, or less ideally, but still an option, build it out with the extra long compression straps, or you can have it sit for short day hunts, even just walking out to your stand.
That's something nice about like the Ute. It's big enough for a lot of people to do backpacking, but I mean, even if you're just day hunting, it can compress down small enough to handle those tasks.
I was wondering.
If you need to add capacity with our system, you can add a pocket to the outside, which will also act as a compression panel. So say if you needed to compress other items such as meat or anything else, you can compress those items in between the pack bag and the pocket itself.
Okay, so it kind of goes around. Because I was looking at pictures of you guys hauling out one of your elk, and it looks like it went right between kind of closer to your back.
Yeah, well, if it was a picture of me, it was a Ute kind of compressed. I barely had anything in there. And then I had all my like day hunting supplies within a car pocket. And then I just compressed in between that bag, which is kind of empty, and the pocket on the outside.
Do you have ever any kind of issues, washing these kind of packs?
cleaning after you have blood on them.
Yeah.
So somewhat commonly known thing, but I kind of came up with a system that seems to work pretty well for cleaning the Cordura. And that's just a 50-50 solution of hydrogen peroxide and water in a spray bottle. You just spray with the blood, take a rag, and just basically agitate and scrub it until it's coming clean. And nice about the peroxide is not only does it disinfect and bring the blood out, it actually foams on the blood or any biological material that's on there.
Like if you poured it in your cut or something.
Yeah, like when you pour it in a cut or whatever, foam up. So you see that same effect on the blood on the pack. So you can always, identify where the problem spots are and then clean until it's no longer foaming.
Yeah, you can always see where the blood is just by the foaming action.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
So you guys run the Ute when you're out elk hunting?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we run the Ute, and that all comes through, I guess, adaptation. The first backpack hunt that you guys watched from last year that Kevin and I did, we were carrying the Kuya, which is of the largest pack. I found that if I give myself the ability to have that larger pack, I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
And we somewhat overpacked for, a backpack hunt.
Sure.
And, we're paying for it down the road with a complete extra trip of packing out camp and the elk. We were able to cut an entire trip out for each of us this year. So that's pretty big. You're talking in the law of thirds again, you're cutting one third out of a trip, but we felt a lot better, even though we had been out in the backcountry longer.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I brought up, start with the bag and figure out what you're going to put in it. Because with the smaller bag, we had to really think about what gear selections were taken. Do I really need this? Do I need that much food? You kind of have to have a better care or thought about it.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it.
Keep stuffing it.
You guys do the jet boiled freeze dried food when you're out there?
Yeah, primarily we're running freeze dries. This year we were doing just one freeze dry a day to cut down on overall weight and actually we found that we ate far less than we thought we were going to.
Really?
And another point to it, I'm not sure if you guys remember from the film or not, but we were able to harvest a grouse the first day. And we added that to the mountain house for a little concoction we like to call grouse in a house.
Nice.
And it
That's
just
nice.
It was a big difference. I carried a 22 pistol in my kit bag.
That's
which
good,
is the original design product from the company Hill People Gear. So I carried a 22 pistol in that kit bag, and that was based off suggestion from my dad, to carry that so that we could procure meat since we were going in so light.
That's a great idea. I mean, when you're out there, because I'm telling you, I don't eat the Mountain House. I had like Wild Zora or something, I think they're called. Anyways, I got sick of that stuff after a while. Even having it once a day, I was ready to be done by the time I was done out there.
You know, I do have a question now. I want to know, kind of going off what James just said, what would be your guys' one like luxury food that you guys have, and then what would be the one meal you would probably never take again just because it was just nasty?
I don't know, man. I like Mountain House.
Yeah.
You're an animal.
I think Mountain House is super tasty for a backpacking meal. I mean, especially from coming from MRE.
MRE. You know what? I'm going to take a side note on that and ask you, what was your favorite MRE?
Chili Mac.
I was going to say. Chili Mac with the cornbread.
Yeah, Jared was in the Marines too, so I know you you're well equipped.
I would mix up that cornbread in the chili mac. I'd put that whole MRE just in one meal and chow that sucker down.
You come up with all kinds of concoctions. Oh, what I would do is I would take the crackers,
wheat bread and cheddar,
peanut butter in there,
and
mix the M&Ms inside. Yeah, I'd make all kinds of weird meals.
I feel like we would get along very well if we were
weird food concoctions. Yeah.
Dude, try this.
Yeah, Jared is a mixer. Yeah. You know, I've seen that hill his in college, and I
leftover soup.
Remember, we would take girls up to the cottage, and we would have been hunting, and we'd be like, "Come up Saturday night." We went up during college. We didn't take Thursday or Friday classes a lot. Mm-hmm. We'd go up there, we'd get a deer, invite some girls up, and our concoction was always all the soup in the cabinet. And then venison in there too.
Of course.
And that was a Jared special. Just pretty much throw everything we can find in the cottage.
We got some spaghetti noodles here.
Gumbo.
Yeah. There's some carrots. All right. All into the soup.
I feel like we really impressed the ladies with that meal though. You know?
Once or twice.
US providers.
Yeah. So on the subject of, you know, what would you take or not? For me, I keep my, what I came up with is that for every ounce I was carrying, it needed to be 100 calorie output. Okay, so that was the easiest way for me when I was walking up and down the aisles of the grocery store, reading nutrition labels, you know, and it's just, when you're just looking for calories at that point, and you're also counting ounces. So I'm going an ounce to 100 calories. And my thing that I'll always go with is dark chocolate as a treat just because of that. It's very high.
In, I was going to say dark chocolate's the thing I wouldn't bring again.
Yeah.
I didn't eat any of it, and it's really heavy.
Well, each their own. It's always an adapting thing. I could probably be 90 years old doing it for the 70th time in my life, and I'm going to not be happy with what I did to some aspect.
You guys ever mess with dehydrating your food? Like taking DIY? Yeah, you know what? I'm getting a dehydrator. I'm like, I wonder if I, because the stuff that I get aren't the cheapest meal. And so I'm like, I think I can cut down some costs by just dehydrating my own, but I've never, I don't know if that would work or not. Like just having a bunch of crazy kind of stuff.
I don't think it would or not.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. The best system I found for cutting costs on the, you know, Mountain House or freeze dries is just buying in bulk.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of stabs you a little bit at first, but when you break it down, you know, I get a bucket off of Amazon or whatever, and it comes out to $5 a meal versus $9 or $8 a meal.
Yeah. And yeah, makes sense.
That's kind of the route I've been going, is just buying in bulk.
So are the meals kind of split, or is that something you guys are individually taking then, since we're on the meal?
We're taking a big
meal. Kevin take all the meals, stuff in his pack. Take the bigger
pack. He had, you know, extra pounds of camera equipment, batteries, the whole thing. I mean, I was carrying a gun, but he was really carrying all the important stuff.
What's an extra couple meals?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of things we do share, though, specifically a tent. The last couple of years, you know, it's nice because you're using a tent together. A two-person tent, so you can split that weight exactly in half.
Yeah,
cut down on bulk for every, you know, each person and weight, and that's kind of nice.
You guys hop in the same sleeping bag, or is it a split sleeping bag situation?
There's a curtain.
It's a double bag. room.
Oh, the classic queen.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you're out, you're filming. And how do you tell me a little bit more about the filming aspect? I mean, the thing that always comes to my mind is trying to figure out battery life. It's got to be an issue when you're out there, right?
Yeah. Keeping everything charged definitely is a big deal, especially when it's cold. I mean, it just drains your batteries. One of the other aspects of trying to film a hunt is not messing up the hunt. basically,
right,
by trying to get a, you know, spooking the animals. Or and another thing is not trying to give away too much of the location, even though we're like in this beautiful scenic area,
right,
all these things around us. I can't really film them all, or else everybody would know exactly where we're at.
So right, you got to be a little covert about it.
Yeah,
because I was watching, looking for landmarks, so I know where to go next mm-hmm. year. But I was, I could,
yeah,
Jimmy's sneaky. Yeah. Well, you got to watch out for him.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you are, you know, you're carrying extra weight, and then, you know, there's long periods of inaction.
Yeah.
That, you know, you don't want to waste, you know, your SD cards on.
Yep.
And then there's short periods of intense action that you can't miss, that it's crucial for the, you know, the drama of the story.
So you guys,
all those factors come into play.
So in those downtimes, you know, probably when you're glassing or, you know, waiting, what do you guys do? You know, what do you do to pass the time? Occasionally, you know, for example, I'll start a fire most of the time because my feet are frozen at that point. But yeah, what do you do? Pass the time when you're up there? You bring a book?
Well, I take naps. I actually was taking a nap this year, and Kevin was still hunting, basically, and he woke me up to a herd of about 90 elk on the side of the hill across from us. a long way. It's out of shooting range for direct action, but
yeah.
I take a lot of midday naps, honestly, just trying to catch up, because you're starting at, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, starting with a hike, maybe getting back late the night before. And so I try and catch up that way. And really in my day hunting setup, you know, sometimes I'll roll with a light book or a magazine or something just to pass the time. But really, if I'm not catching up on a little bit of sleep, I just try and stay behind the glass if I can,
right,
because you just never know when you're going to, you know, especially in big open Western country, when you're going to stumble across that flick of the ear or an antler sticking out, or, you know, so it's good to always like try and just be aware of what's going on around you if possible, you know. Yeah. And it also glassing's fun too, because you'll see all kinds of things, deer, coyotes, even mountain lions. I've seen mountain lions before just from standing behind the glass. So.
Yeah. You know, it's good. And that's like a good point. One thing I like about you, Jared, I've never said this to you before. One thing I appreciate you about you is hunting with you is when we're behind the glass, I feel like you got a good pair of eyes. I can always kind of Jared to find things sometimes.
You're not the first person to tell me.
You know, it's handy because it's like, and I feel like I'm pretty good at finding things, but if you got a guy who's not really carrying his weight, it's like you feel like you're doing all the work, like Tom over here, who you know, he's okay.
That's the same thing.
But that's what I like about you, dude.
I just have no idea what he's looking at.
right.
Things just pop out of nowhere for him, and for me not so much.
I would say it's a long-term adaptation to having the game eye. Because there's no other way I could really explain it, you know. I mean, Kevin's been hunting the last couple of years with me, and just every time we go out, like, I see him like picking up things like more every single time.
Yeah.
So it's learning, but I guess then a lot of times it is just like some people have, I guess, that instinct to see the movement or something out of place. It's hard to say, you know, it's different
for
everybody.
It's funny though. You say like, once you start practicing it, you get better at it. So my wife and I will drive around. I always am spotting deer. She's like, how'd you see the deer? So I kind of explained some of my methodologies for for finding them, you know, the shape of the back or, you know, a different color or whatever else. And now that she started doing it, we got a pretty good game eye too. It's kind of handy too. It's good to be around somebody who's got a good game eye. It's pretty essential in life, I think. If you don't have a good game eye partner,
I think if you think everyone else has good eyes, I think you just might
maybe
have
I'm just a terrible I'm terrible. Am I bad? Would you tell me? I'm great.
If you think everyone else in the room is crazy, you're probably the crazy one.
You guys.
And a lot of it is movement based for me. It's so I glass off of a tripod all the time, and I'm not very steady just offhand glassing. So I'm always on that tripod.
Okay.
Immediately. I mean, I might make a quick scan while I'm setting up just to make sure there's not something standing right below me, which is kind of actually the case that happened last year on our hunt, just coming right up to the glassing knob and there was an elk 150 yards away, which almost never happens, but it can, you know. So there's always that, you know, quick scan. But pretty much right away, as soon as I sat down, I'm putting my glass on the tripod and I'm watching for movement primarily. And that's how I like to roll with it. And it's just less fatiguing, you know. I mean, you keep your arms up in a 90-degree, you know, lockout on the glass for so long, and you're gonna just get a little tired, a little bored, and you're gonna start playing with the stick down here, doing something. You can stay on that tripod and keep your hands just nice and rested and watch for movement. So it kind of helps it for fatigue and for stability.
Yeah, this year I tried to go real light. So I was going to use my hiking trekking poles as a kind of like a tripod. And I feel like I just wish I would have brought a tripod, you know?
Yeah. I mean, a sturdy tripod will work better as a trekking pole than a pair of trekking poles will work for a tripod, I've kind of found. So,
oh, yeah, and I already broke my trekking pole, so it's, you know. It was, I gave it to my brother who, you know, made fun of me the entire trip out to Colorado, like, for bringing these poles the first year I ever used them. He's like, what are you using those for? You can't walk. You know, we get there. He's the one that was dying, so I gave him one. I'm like, here, you take them both. I'll just walk, because he was dead. So halfway through, I hear a bell. Smashed one of them. So I'm like, you know, you were giving me a hard time, then you use them, and then you break them.
Jake's not a small boy.
Worst brother ever. He's not.
No, yeah, that happened, you know, our hunt last year. Mm-hmm. I didn't bring trekking poles, and that was a major disaster. It's like,
it saves so much energy. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah, especially when you have, you get there and your lung capacity doesn't feel like it's where it needs to be. And it's like any extra help you can have is a huge deal.
Yeah, mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah, well, and it just less wear on the body. I mean, yeah. You feel it, you know, and you feel it in your knees, and you're just taking, even if it's only 15 or 20% of the weight of the load, you're just taking that and you're transferring it to four pillars instead of two. And that's another principle of load carriage in a way. The human body was not made or designed to carry high amounts of weight unless it was on your head. And that's just because we're more of a two pillar system and a one pillar system in the spine. And that kind of goes back to the original design principles of load carriage that Evan and Scott were hitting on when they first designed the gear.
Yeah, I just pulled up pictures of, I was going to pull up, there it is, the picture of you hauling out a quarter. I think it's Kevin, it's you with some meat on your back on the looking out over the landscape with your one trekking pole. Deep in thought.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was carrying like a camera on a monopod, actually. So Casey, I was carrying one trekking pole and then the monopod, and then Casey took the monopod with the camera on it to take that picture. Yeah. I could only have one trekking pole because
that makes sense. It looks, and
you
actually
did a good job.
Looking at that picture, it actually makes me wonder something. So you were wearing those gaiters, those outdoor research. I actually literally just got a pair. How do you like, this is my first year using gaiters with my hiking boots. And I think a lot of times that's led to freezing feet because the water soaks up your pant leg, goes into your boot, and then you're cold. How do those things work?
So the gaiters work really well. I mean, they're crucial for, you know, hiking in the snow, in my opinion. Now the boots I had weren't the best.
There was an equipment failure this year.
I feel like there's a story.
I got cold feet basically when Casey was processing the animal, and he was looking at me like I need to help him, and I was like, oh man, I can't because my feet are freezing off, and I need to start fire.
When they get cold, man, that mountain cold toe. I got frostbite on all the tips of my toes out there. My whole boot, I remember, just froze into one ice chunk, and I just thought, this is the worst thing that could be happening to me right now.
I wasn't at that point. Yeah,
I mean, they worked. I mean, the boots worked well for me the season previous.
Okay.
They degraded down and just did not hold the waterproofness as well.
Yeah. You looking to get any new boots? What are you looking at?
I'm always looking for new boots.
It's a game.
It is, really. You're always looking for these specific features that are always hard to come by, especially when we're at 12 and a half, because nobody wants to make a half.
Well, and that's the worst thing, too, is you don't want to go into the backcountry with a brand new boot that you haven't ground truth or tested. And so going in, you know, Kevin's thinking, hey, this boot worked great last year. It kept my foot dry, blah, 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 and it's going to be good. And then you have unexpected gear failure, where apparently the Gore-Tex membrane must have worn out in it or something.
Yeah.
And that caused the feet to get wet. That caused them to get cold. I think we were down to single digits that day throughout the entire day, the day that we harvested the elk. It was cold, cold, you know, and just adapting from that. And being like, okay, well, you know, we're starting a fire and we're going to warm up and get this dealt with, you know. So,
do you guys like a stiffer stole, or are you more of a flexible? So we just had this conversation with I think Aaron Snyder about it. Like, do you like a little bend in your sole, or do you find like a real stiff, rigid sole to work better?
It depends on the terrain, really. I mean, if it's really rocky terrain, yeah, a little bit more stiff sole. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's not so rocky and more just kind of like dirt and grass and stuff like that, then yeah, a little bit more flexible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a hard question because down in Mexico, it's very volcanic down there. So underneath this layer of grass, there's just basically a bunch of round rocks the size of basketballs that are hidden. So you're walking around on this very unstable ground. And I took my pair of boots that were a little lighter with a very soft midsole that moved a lot just because they were lighter weight, better for warmer weather. And I had wished that I had a stiffer, right, more mountaineering style boot for that terrain. So, I mean, it's the options there. I like to bring a stiff boot and a not stiff boot and then kind of make a game time decision based on what I'm seeing out there.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference. The right boot. I think I'm trying to pair a Solewas this year. So we'll see if those are nice. I did Merrells last year and I regretted it.
I don't have any Solewa like heavier boots, but I love my Solewas. So I think that's probably a pretty good option. They're a good company.
Yeah, they're good. I think they're the mountain trainer, so they're not the stiffest of soles, but I'm gonna try them out. Mm-hmm. So what do you guys got planned next year? What's your next upcoming, what film will we get to watch next?
Well, that all kind of depends on how the draw goes, I guess, you know. Yeah. What tags we're able to get a hold of. Actually looking out to put the camera down for a season of elk hunting anyway, and yeah, get out there with Kevin to harvest his first elk, hopefully.
Yeah, get behind the rifle and put behind the camera this time.
Yeah.
We would like to film something. Yeah, definitely. We would like to film something a little different, maybe a mule deer hunt or, man, if he's lucky, even a goat hunting, but that's high hopes there.
Yeah, you know, any of the limited draws, goat, pronghorn, moose, something like that would be really cool, but at least hopefully a mule deer hunt of some kind or whatnot. But just try and change it up, you know, from elk hunting, show a little more diverse hunting. Yeah, so.
You guys do a lot of editing when you put those together. They look really nice. It's really well done.
Yeah, it's hours upon hours of reviewing footage and then putting them together in a timeline and finding music that you can use and then doing voiceover and trying to piece all these pieces together and then having, you know, a computer system crash and then trying to recover all those things. You just put all that hard work into it's hours upon hours of work. Especially for something, I forget how long the film is, but it's quite a bit of work at that
point. And that was all Kevin. I'm giving, you know, full credit to the film and and the editing. He worked the better part of a month all editing that film after. So while I was, you know, still running around in the hills doing other hunts and everything, I'd come in once in a while and record a little voiceover and give him some feedback. But I mean, he was grinding on the editing side of things, and he's a really good editor. He can edit and bring to life a story that, I mean, I couldn't even imagine it this year, you know, like having gone through the whole event and then seeing how he portrayed it. I was like, dude, you're making me look too good. That's not
right. You looked really like cool out there. I mean, you looked definitely like you knew what you were doing.
He does know what he's doing.
Some solid editing. Well, you know, guys, thank you so much for coming on. We're about running up on time. For everybody listening, go to the Hill People Gear. I think it's on YouTube, right? Check out this video. Go to their website. Hill People Gear makes really awesome stuff, and these are two really great guys. So, guys, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the film is called Colorado Elk Hunt, just on our YouTube channel. And check out, you know, the Hill People Gear Instagram as well. Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Nice to talk.
Yeah, good to meet you guys.